Welcome to In the Middle. I'm Joey Block. We have a lot of news to get to, so let's get right in the middle of it. Former President Trump is calling out the judge in his New York criminal trial over the gag order. In his first rally since the start of the trial, he criticized Judge Juan Merchan, saying, quote, "There is no crime. I have a crooked judge. He's a totally conflicted judge," close quote. On the gag order, the former president said, quote, "The judge, by the way, is the most conflicted person in history. I don't think there's ever been a more conflicted judge. Crooked and conflicted. I'm unconstitutionally gagged. He gagged me. So I'm not even supposed to be, I would say, talking to you because he gagged me," close quote. Trump went on to say, quote, "I've got to do two of these things a day. You know why? Because I'm in New York all the time with the Biden trial. It's a fake trial. They do it to try and take your powers away. Try and take your candidate away," close quote. This comes after he received a $9,000 fine for making public statements about people connected to the criminal case. In doing so, Judge Merchan warned Trump if he continued to violate the gag order, quote, "an incarcerary punishment would be imposed upon him." Trump deleted the post in question from his Truth Social account and ripped off his campaign website these very posts following the fine. Merchan is currently weighing other alleged gag order violations brought by the prosecution. So there's obviously a lot to break down here, for sure. But the point that we do have to mention before we do that is the good news for Trump is the judge will allow him to attend his son Barron's high school graduation. So he's going to get a day off for that. But you see the game here that is at play for Trump is he now has to walk this fine line every time he goes to a rally when talking about the case. He is allowed to talk about the judge and about Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, but when it comes to anything else like a juror or a clerk involved with the judge or the judge's family, anything like that, or even witnesses in the case like Michael Cohen, that could be a problem. Because if you recall, this whole gag order thing started when Michael Cohen went on MSNBC talking about the case, criticizing the former president, to which the former president took to Truth Social and criticized Cohen and for doing those MSNBC appearances. And then there's some people in the Trump camp who say Cohen should have a gag order. So a lot of drama there in terms of gag orders. And as you know, former President Trump is running for president this year. So being completely isolated is not really something he can do politically. Although he has Wednesdays and the weekends, obviously, and then at night he can go and do whatever he wants. But he still has to be in New York 4 days a week to be at this trial. Because unlike the civil trials that he's had to deal with, he has to be at every single one. Every time they gavel in for the day, he's got to be there. This is not like with the E. Jean Carroll trial or the civil fraud trial, all those things. He didn't have to be there for that. He wanted to be there for a lot of it, but he didn't have to be. Like, if he had to go do something else, which, for example, when Melania Trump's mother died, he took a day off while the trial was ongoing and went to the funeral because the judge wouldn't make an exception for him because the argument was, well, you don't have to be here. So in that respect, Trump was able to get out of it for that day. But here, he has to be there. So this is a part of the campaign for him, is he has to try and, one, he has to talk about it because he has to kind of explain away because it's the thing that's happening. Everybody knows about it. But at the same time, he has to utilize it in a way that's going to get him political bonus points because his base sees this as a two-tier justice system thing. You heard it earlier. He's basically trying to say that President Biden is directing the prosecutions, that all these things are connected, and that there's a double standard here for Republicans compared to Democrats, where, you know, people like Hunter Biden and Hillary Clinton get off scot-free. That is what he's dealing with there. So he has to appeal to those people, clearly. But then he's also got to bring the people in the middle of the road who maybe they don't have an opinion on this. Maybe they want to hear about other stuff. Or if they do, he has to change the game for them and make this argument to them that, you know, don't pay attention to any of this. This is really all a bunch of nothing. Well, obviously his critics, they're all into this. They claim this is like DEFCON 3, basically, that this is completely unprecedented and disqualifies him from being president. And if you see the way the Trump team is handling this case, you can tell they're starting to poke holes in this argument. Even the whole thing with Keith Davison, Stormy Daniels' attorney, they basically tried to make him seem like a tabloid, ambulance seeker kind of guy. They basically brought up how he was involved with exposing the Hulk Hogan sex tape a decade ago, as well as getting documents for TMZ regarding details of Lindsay Lohan's stay in rehab. Both controversial things, because especially with the rehab thing, it's not really clear whether he had the ability to do that, and what means. Did he pay someone off and get it? And they tried to poke this while he was in court. And, you know, basically, Davidson's like, well, that's just hearsay. This is all during cross-examination, because obviously Davidson's there trying to support Cohen side of the thing, basically saying that there was a hush money payment. And they talked about this phone conversation the two of them had. Basically, he kind of threw Cohen a little bit under the bus, basically saying that in 2018, he felt that Cohen was recording him and that Cohen seemed like a guy who wasn't really in control of the situation, and that the former president was having him do his bidding. So in that sense, there was this conversation where there was a sense of regret of doing the hush money payment, and that was brought into play here. But the Trump team saying, well, you know, Trump didn't know about any of this. This is essentially Cohen just being a rogue actor, considering he paid money to Stormy Daniels and didn't even get anything paid back for it. Of course, that is also an argument of whether Cohen got something in cash, and there's debates around that too. But this is something you're going to start to see here from the criminal defense side, is they're going to try and poke holes in a way that's almost similar to the way Trump does his politics. They're going to do the oppo research into all these people that the prosecution puts up on the stand, and they're going to cross-examine them and poke holes. And it may seem a little flamboyant at times, where they're going to throw these bombastic claims in there. But again, we could see some potential truth, because this guy, Davison, was involved in these things. So there's that too. But again, there's also the question of whether it happened. And there's recordings that we're starting to see of one, Trump and Cohen, and then Cohen and Davison talking about this type of payment. And that is essentially the case of this, because Trump has denied any of this at all. He's one, denied the affairs with Kara McDougal and Stormy Daniels. And this guy Davison also represented Kara McDougal too. And basically, the Trump team's trying to cast this as no, nothing here. Well, the prosecution, they're trying to make the big deal here that this happened, we have the evidence that happened, and this violated the campaign finance rule. Because that's the question. When did it happen? Did the affair happen with any of these women? Because Trump denies it. There is a picture of him and Stormy together. That's back in the early 2000s, I believe. So there is that. Then, okay, happened. Was there money paid off there? Okay, so the money's there. But then, okay, what was the reason for it? Was it a campaign finance thing? Yes, it happened right around the lead up to the 2016 election. But what was the reason? Was it the fact that he just didn't want to deal with it because he was embarrassed by the details? Did he think it would be bad for his business? Not so much the campaign, because as you recall, a lot of people didn't think Trump was going to win in 2016. A lot of people were really surprised by that. And there is sourcing to suggest that Trump himself didn't even think he was going to win, that he was shocked to the point where they didn't even have a victory speech prepared. He kind of had to go out there and wing it, although he does that basically anyways, but they had nothing prepared. At 3 a.m, they're just like, oh, I guess he won. And there was a bit of shock going on there. So if that were the case, then maybe it wasn't about his campaign at all. Maybe it was more about his business. So there's that too. And then there is the fact that he is and was married at the time to Melania. Maybe he just didn't want her to find out about it because he didn't want to hear about it. He didn't want her nagging on him about why he had an affair, not once, but twice. Because there was that awkwardness, obviously, that came with the Access Hollywood tape where while Melania is pregnant with their son, Baron, he's talking about how he's hitting on Nancy O'Dell. So you have that at play, and they could prove that, one, it happened, but you got to prove the reason behind it, because also, as you know, with the statue that Bragg is prosecuting this thing on, it's a lot of it is beyond the statute of limitations because it's only around 5 years, and we're going on 8 here. So then he elevated to a federal charge, which would bring it, one, from a misdemeanor to a felony, and he's not a federal prosecutor, so there's that at play too. But again, the defense is going to have to, quote unquote, go on defense in regards to what happened here because they have things to defend. How far are they going to go? Are they going to go all the way and say, "This none of this ever happened, Trump's a good man, loyal to Melania, this and that"? Or are they going to say, okay, maybe this happened, maybe there was an affair, maybe there was even a payment, but the payment didn't go because of the campaign, because they got to prove the money trail too. The banks between Trump's personal finance account going into the Trump campaign or Cohen getting reimbursed by the campaign. These are all the things that have to be laid out in the trial. And that's what we're going to have to see, whether the defense or the prosecution can make that case. So we will have to see what transpires with all that, as well as the gag order, because as of this recording, Marchand has not ruled on the remaining allegations regarding gag orders. So we're going to have to see. Maybe were there some violations, and could Trump possibly be thrown in jail for a brief time? That would make news for sure. We'll be watching that and seeing where that's going there. But we have to go further south here, down to D.C., where the Republican caucus, there's a lot of family drama going on down there. Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia, well, she is not happy with Mike Johnson at all, to the fact that she plans to call for a vote to oust the House Speaker next week at a press conference with fellow Republican Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massie. Greene said Johnson needs to go because he has fallen flat on advancing conservative causes. While holding up a MAGA hat, she said, quote, "We need leaders in the House of Representatives that are going to get this done. Mike Johnson is not capable of that job. Every member of Congress needs to take that vote and let the chips fall where they may." Greene and Massie say they're giving their colleagues the weekend to think it over, but so far they only have the support of one other member of their own conference, Arizona Congressman Paul Gosar. So really, there's only 3 Republicans who want to oust Johnson as of this recording. They also say Johnson could just simply resign and then the whole matter would be tabled altogether. Now, unlike the last time that this was tried by the Republican caucus when they ousted Kevin McCarthy, the Democrats are not going to give them the assist. They're not helping them this time. As House Democratic leadership came out against the motion to vacate, saying that they will vote to table it if it comes to the floor. So this time, the Democrats are not giving the assist. Now, there's no guarantee that all the Democrats are going to fall in line, but as you know, with House Democratic leadership, they get their way a lot of times. So that means a majority of the Democratic caucus will probably vote with Hakeem Jeffries and the like. But there could be some defectors. How many defectors? That's where we have to do the math there, is where the defecting is coming from here. Now, Johnson is respondent to all this. In a statement, he says the move to get rid of him is, quote, wrong for the Republican conference, wrong for the institution, and wrong for the country, close quote. This comes after Johnson allowed a foreign aid package to come to the floor that ultimately passed the House, which included funding for Ukraine, something many Republicans have expressed opposition to. Johnson moved the legislation through the chamber with the help of Democratic votes. So that's a piece of controversy right there, is that it's this old-fashioned, old-time debate of the Republicans saying, you're not loyal enough to the party. You're the D.C. insider. That is the argument Green is making here, all because of Ukraine, that he let that funding go and that they got the votes for it after making this whole big push about how there was going to be no more funding for Ukraine, and then the money for Ukraine went, along with other things. There was funding for Gaza, and there were some members of the Republican caucus that weren't happy about that, that there should have been no humanitarian aid, should have only been for the Jewish state of Israel. So there's that part of it too. There's a lot of interesting factors to this here that you're going to have to watch here. And one, the Democrats, why are they helping Johnson? Well, a couple reasons. One, he passed their big priority. They wanted that Ukraine aid desperately. They also wanted that humanitarian aid for the people of Gaza. Mike Johnson, one, let that go to the floor, and two, got the votes to pass it. So they worked together to get this done. So they owe him a little bit in that respect. This is not because they love Mike Johnson, by the way. If they had it their way, Hakeem Jeffries would be speaker right now. And that brings me to another point. You know, Jeffries and the whole gang, Kathleen Clark, Pete Aguilar, they're doing the math here. They're putting the whip together, and they're checking every box. They're trying to see where they can get these votes, because it's a very slim majority. It is possible for a Democrat to be elected Speaker of the House. It does not have to be the majority party who controls the speakership. That's just usually the way it is, because it's the obvious. It's a numbers game, and there's more Republicans than Democrats. Just like back in previous Congresses, when Nancy Pelosi was the Democratic Speaker, there were more Democrats than Republicans, so you wouldn't see a guy like Kevin McCarthy just suddenly get the Speaker's gavel. So there is that part of it too, is that they are trying to see, because there's always been this school of thought, oh, maybe the moderate Republicans will just get so disgusted, they're just going to throw their hands in the air and be like, all right, we're just going to vote for a Democrat to be Speaker so we can get back to business here and end this. What the Democrats must be finding here is that they're not getting those Republican votes that they thought may be possible. Now, a reason for that could be is people could see it as a career ender, because the whole point of going to Washington for these Republicans when they were running back in 2022 was to be a check on the Biden administration. Well, how do you check on the Biden administration if you're electing a Democratic House Speaker who's going to work with the Biden administration? So imagine trying to pitch that in your reelection bid. Hey, remember when I told you I was going to be a check on the Biden administration? Well, you know what? I put this Democratic House Speaker there, and they're basically doing the same thing as they were doing before I got here. That's a little harder for a Republican member to go home to their district and their constituents and tell them. So that could be part of this too, is they're not seeing the votes, and they're thinking, all right, well, we could get Johnson. We could get someone else. We may have no one, and then we can't do anything. So we might as well keep the guy in power for now. There could also be a long game strategy here, is that they want to keep Johnson around because they know he is facing some opposition, and that they're hoping it's going to grow to the point where he does eventually get ousted. And then they'll be able to try and get Hakeem Jeffries into the speakership. Bold move, but maybe it's possible. Maybe they're leaning on those Republicans. They're trying to work some deals here, because that would be historic if that actually happened. So we're going to have to see if That is the play for the Democrats. But then back to Green, why is she doing this? Well, if you've noticed or heard, she has raised some money off of this, along with Paul Gosar and along with Thomas Massie. These are the outsiders. Now, Green has become a little more into the fold as things have gone along here, but she's still more or less not the mainstream. So if you're not in the mainstream, you don't have access to the same establishment donor base as the country club Republicans, as people like Mike Lawler, Tom Kaine, Steve Scalise, Jim Jordan, like those people have. And they don't, a lot of these people, I mean, Green has the profile, but Paul Gosar, who's, you know, also been censured in the House previously, Marjorie Taylor Greene thrown off a committee, people like that have a harder time with the donor class to get the money. So, hey, if you look like you're fighting for your voters, maybe they'll throw some money at you. You'll get some small dollar contributions and be able enough to get a re-election bid. Now, obviously, especially with Marjorie Taylor Greene's unique position, she is in a very, very conservative district. So she doesn't have too much to worry about there. But at the same time, you got to have something in the war chest. God forbid you get a Republican challenger. She really doesn't have anything worth worry about there. But who knows? Something happens. Maybe the Democrats throw some money in there and, you know, makes her life more miserable. So if you have that you're playing with, then maybe you need to have that smokescreen there. You need to look like you're doing something. And then the doing something, because as you know, it has been very tough to get legislation passed because of the slim majority. Because Republicans something, oh, the big wave, the red wave's coming, the red wave's coming. Well, as we saw, it was more of a ripple. And really only in certain parts of the country did we see it to the point where they had just the right numbers to get over the finish line. And now that there's all these vacancies, their numbers are shrinking in terms of a majority. So if you're Green and Massie, maybe you're thinking, well, you know, we're not really getting anything done here. We got to look like we're doing something. Otherwise, our voters are going to get mad at us. So if we say Johnson is the problem and we try to remove him, then we look like we're doing something. It's an interesting dynamic. And then the question I will leave you with this is, well, what does Trump think? Because Trump clearly likes Johnson. They had the press conference together a couple weeks back. So Trump's in support of him. But wait, Green is also very much in Trump's camp. So how does that work? It could be a permission structure. Could be, all right, you can do this, but you can't actually do it. Basically, you've heard that Green and Massie basically have been trying this resignation thing, but now it's gone to the point of, okay, well, now here's the real deal. We have to actually do something. Could be maybe Trump's putting pressure on other Republicans to where said, all right, let them do their thing, but you guys, you have to stay together here. We can't have the House fall into the Democrats. That could be happening behind the scenes. We'll have to see what Trump's involvement is. We're going to have to see how Johnson deals with that and whether Green truly brings the motion to vacate to the floor. Maybe the last moment she's like, you know, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. We have a deal. Could be deal working because remember, Johnson's been in talks with Green for weeks now, trying to hash out something and to prevent this from happening. But he could still be trying. He could still be working the phones. We have a weekend. They could be talking. We'll have to see. Maybe they're working the phones to see what opposition they can pull together. It's something that a lot of political observers in Washington are going to keep an eye on and see if Johnson can become the second speaker in U.S. history to be ousted. We'll be watching that for sure. But here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. We're about a month away from primary day here in New Jersey, and voters are set to go to the polls to cast their ballots for a number of offices across the state, including Senate as well as for president. There's also a number of House races we're watching, especially on the Democratic side, in light of the county organizational line no longer being in play for that party's primary. One of these races is in South Jersey, where one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit that struck down the county line, Carolyn Rush, is running for Congress there. She is vying for the Democratic nomination in the 2nd Congressional District, home to one of the reddest areas in the state. Rush is going up against former prosecutor Tim Alexander, businessman Joe Salerno, and Rodney Dean. Now, if she were to advance to the general election, Rush would likely be going up against Republican Congressman Jeff Van Drew, who notably changed his party affiliation following his vote against former President Trump's first impeachment, where he was just one of two Democrats to oppose the effort. The district has moved with Van Drew, becoming a conservative stronghold following redistricting, where it used to be more competitive for Democrats. Joining me now is New Jersey 2nd District Democratic Congressional candidate Carolyn Rush. Carolyn, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
You're currently running for the Democratic nomination in the 2nd Congressional District. What made you decide to throw your hat into the ring?
The thing that pushed me to do that is the total dysfunction that I see in Congress. I'm very frustrated by the fact that they are not getting legislation passed, because after all, that's what we send our representatives to DC to do for us. And I am to a point in my life where I'd like to do something where I can make a difference. My children are grown and out of the house. I think I have the skills that are necessary, not political skills, but people skills, to go to Congress and help bring people together so that we can look for common ground. And once we've found all of that, work on compromise in the areas where there's disagreement. So I'm an eternal optimist. I have hope that we can do a better job legislating for the people of our country, and I want to be part of making that happen. So that's really why I decided to run.
You mentioned that you have people skills, and you say that that will help bring people together in Congress and that it will help work on compromise and stuff like that. But we do have to point out, you've never held public office before.
That is correct.
What other experience would you bring to the table that would benefit you in Congress?
I spent a 35-year career as an engineer. I've worked in both software engineering, systems engineering, and engineering management. So as an engineer, the main thing that you do is look to solve problems. So you are constantly trying to figure out the best solution to a situation that needs help. As a manager, you're always looking to get the best possible outcomes with your team. So I've developed skills over the years of bringing people together, making sure that everybody realizes that their input is valued, and working together to find the best solution. So I think that my management skills and my problem solving skills are the things that I bring to the table that will be helpful. Plus, I raised 5 children, and I think that a lot of the behavior that we see in Congress is very childish. So I know how to deal with that. So there are a number of different aspects of my life experience that I will put to good use.
We do have to point out, though, there is a reality here. You're running in a red district. The incumbent there, Republican Congressman Jeff Van Drew, won by 19 points in his last reelection bid. How do you plan to compete with that?
Well, I don't think that the candidate who ran against him 2 years ago ran a strong enough campaign. I have every intention of reminding my fellow constituents in the 2nd District of the areas in which Jeff Van Drew has failed us. Now, Jeff Van Drew won this district as a Democrat. So it was not that long ago that the people of this district were willing to put a Democrat in Congress. So you can say it's a red district, but I see it more as purple. I am going after the youth vote and the independent vote, hoping that there's enough people, because there's many more independents in our district than there are either Democrats or Republicans. So it is my opinion that if we tell them, share with them the things that have happened over the last several years that are not in the best interest of the people of our district, and let them know that there's an alternative, then I think we can change minds. So I'm very optimistic. I think that if I can get through the primary, fighting against Democrats, I think, is the tougher part. I'm confident that I can fight against Jeff Van Drew and win.
You mentioned how it's hard for you to fight against Democrats as opposed to getting in the general election. I'll get to that in a moment, but just focusing on Van Drew himself, the fact is he was more of a conservative Democrat throughout his time in the state legislature, and then when he was in Congress, that's kind of how he ran and kind of how he was a lot of the time. Given that dynamic, do you consider yourself a conservative or moderate Democrat? Because some people say that's the only way this district may be won. It's not going to be won based on being a progressive Democrat.
I'm not one for labels. I would say that I am very fiscally responsible, that I do not want to see my tax dollars or any other folks in my district have their tax dollars spent poorly. But I'm also one who believes that the government should work for the people. And Jeff Van Drew, when he ran in 2018, he had 100% rating with Planned Parenthood. So say what you will about him, but he supported a women's right to choose. Now, he's firmly against it at this point. And that bothers me, because I think that women should make their own choices about their reproductive organs and how they are utilized, not the government. And I think that that is an issue that cuts across the aisle. And that takes me to another point. When Jeff Van Drew was a Democrat, he did work across the aisle. You're right. He tried to find common ground with Republicans. But now that he is a Republican, there is no give and take with him. He is staunchly on the far right side. So not only has he changed positions, changed parties, he's changed his outlook on too many things. He used to be a strong supporter of veterans, but I worked with a local leader in the veteran community, and he shared with me about 16 pieces of legislation that made it through Congress this year. So they got a yes vote. They're law now. They're not just, you know, bills anymore. They're laws. Jeff Van Drew voted against about 12 of them. So that tells me that his desire to take care of the people who served our country is not as strong as it used to be. And that bothers me. And I hope it bothers other people. And I think people need to know that. So I'm running a campaign to make sure that people are aware of what's going on and they don't just look at the D or the R that's next to the person's name.
You brought up Van Drew's record on abortion. That's something I want to talk about there, because there's this debate right now about what's acceptable, what's not, are there exceptions, at what point should it be legal, what point should it not be. Do you think there should be any restrictions on abortion? Should there be a moderate stance, or is it you're all in or you're all out?
It's an area that when I get to Congress, I would like to sit down at the table and hash it out with others. When the Dobbs decision first came down, there were two pieces of legislation that were offered up to deal with the fall of Roe. One was in the House, and if you remember correctly, in the House of Representatives, it was Nancy Pelosi who was still in charge, because we're going back a few years ago, right? So a piece of legislation got put through with absolutely no restrictions. And it passed in the House because it was under the control of Democrats. All they needed was 50%. I think they got slightly over that. But it never stood a chance in the Senate. So it didn't even hit the floor there. But conversely, in the Senate, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski introduced a piece of legislation in the Senate that called for the same restrictions that Roe had before it fell. Because if you remember correctly, Roe v. Wade, there were lawsuits brought against that which didn't overturn it but put restrictions on it. So what I would like to do is sit down with Republican legislators and figure out what is acceptable, because we lived for years with some restrictions. I think having, legal abortion with restrictions is better than having it illegal and seeing what's happening to women in the, you know, in so many of these states. It's just, I think unacceptable that a woman who's having a miscarriage can't get the care that she needs and ends up having to go septic or having to have a hysterectomy just because the doctors are afraid of being sued if they do what they believe is medically necessary. It's a terrible state that our country is in right now with regards to women's health care.
So you would support an abortion law that doesn't allow for 100% abortion no matter what, that let's say it's a 15-week or a 17-week limit with exceptions, obviously the exceptions being it can go a little longer at that. Is that something you could get behind, that it doesn't necessarily, if a woman can't get an abortion for any reason whatsoever in the third trimester, would that be acceptable to you?
Yeah, because I don't think that's happening anyway. I think any woman who makes it to the third trimester and requests an abortion is doing it because she's been told that the pregnancy is no longer viable or that continuing the pregnancy will impact her health. And if that's the case, the exception being that the health of the woman, not just the life of the woman, but if the health of the woman is at stake, at risk, then it has to be legal for her to get that abortion, even in the final trimester. If the pregnancy is not viable or the woman is going to be, you know, to suffer because of it, she has to have the right to take the medically necessary action. So I would support that, but I don't want politicians deciding if it's okay for her to get it or not. I mean, if a woman presents and needs to have a procedure, I don't want the doctors making that decision. So I would support, like, I think Roe v. Wade said up to the point of viability. And that's beyond 15 weeks. You can't deliver a baby at 15 weeks and have it survive on its own. So the point of viability should be the cutoff. And after that, it is with a doctor saying that it is necessary, not with a judge or a politician. But yes, I will support whatever it takes to get that legislation through, because the situation that we have right now is unacceptable.
I want to go back to something you said earlier. You said that the challenge is more getting through the Democratic primary than it is getting through the general election. You were one of the plaintiffs in Congressman Andy Kim's lawsuit that led to the county organizational line being struck down in this year's Democratic primary. Now that the line is gone, how has that impacted your race for Congress?
It has made my chances much better. I ran 2 years ago, and I was not bestowed the county line. In fact, I had somebody in the county party that didn't like me actively campaigning against me, and he made sure that I did not get the county line. So I was in ballot Siberia. And even being in ballot Siberia, I managed to garner 10,000 votes to Tim Alexander's 17,000. Now, that was the highest vote count for a non-county line candidate. So I know that 10,000 people went looking for me on that ballot because they had to. I was off to the side, sitting by myself, where most people don't even know what you're doing over there. So there were 10,000 people that wanted to vote for me. I'm making sure that number is much higher. But it's tough in a Democratic primary because there's a general rule, and I abide by it, that you don't say bad things about your opponents. So you play nice. You try to, you know, not offend people. But I think that my chances are much better now that we are in a block and we're all different counties have me in different positions. Sometimes I'm on the top, sometimes I'm on the bottom. It doesn't matter. They're going to have to figure out who they want to vote for, not just go in and vote down the line. So I think it has enhanced my chances, and I am very confident in my abilities this time.
You mentioned that you're going to be on the top of some of the ballots. That would be in Ocean and Cumberland County. Have you seen more energy in those areas for your campaign since that decision has been made?
Not necessarily. I haven't. I don't. have the money right now to do any polling, so I don't have anything official. I have been doing advertising and making a lot of phone calls and doing outreach, holding a lot of meet and greets. The people that I'm reaching out to are very receptive, but I can't say that I've seen anything different in the two counties where I fortunately drew the top position. I don't really think it matters that much, to be honest with you. I think when you have four candidates in a box, it's being at the top or the bottom. I mean, I think I'm at the bottom on Atlantic County, but the thing is, I'm right next to President Biden. So if people are kind of picking Biden, I'm right next to him. So it's like, it could help, it could hurt, who knows? But I can't say that I have anything quantifiable about being on the top in those two counties. We'll know after the election, maybe.
We'll have to see for sure on that, but yeah. I want to dive deeper into the decision itself, because critics on the right are blasting the federal judge who made the ruling, saying he should have declared the county line unconstitutional for the GOP primary as well. The judge said his ruling only applies to the Democratic primary. Now, a few Republicans did try to get the line eliminated in their primary, but a lower court ruled that it was already too late. Should the judge have struck down the line for the Republicans as well?
I think so. I was surprised. I mean, I was pleased at his decision, but I was surprised that it was applied only to Democrats. So I think that it should have been for everyone. But that's the only part of the judge's position that I didn't really understand. But the Republicans that wanted to be part of it should have requested, I forget what the legal term is, but they should have requested it sooner. But I'm just glad that it was taken care of for the Democratic Party.
Though the line will be in place for most GOP primaries around the state, the Burlington County clerk made the bold decision of tossing out the line altogether, meaning that both Democrats and Republicans are going to be running an office block voting in that county. The initial ruling does allow clerks to do this type of thing if they wish, but most of them didn't really take up that offer. Should more county clerks have gone that route?
Oh, I don't know. That's a decision left up to the clerks. I was actually shocked that only one did it, or really that one did it without being explicitly told to. I can understand it, because as far as the clerks are concerned, it probably makes it easier for them if all the ballots are designed in a similar way. But I don't necessarily have an opinion about what the clerks should do. I'm just glad about the way things worked out for the Democratic Party.
Now, in light of this ruling, there's been questions raised about the political structure here in New Jersey. You even brought up yourself how there was someone in one of the counties that you were running in actively campaigning against you because you say they simply did not like you. And even without the line, party leaders will still be able to issue endorsements, awarding their preferred candidates with the county slogan, along with resources to bolster campaigns. Tom Moran wrote an op-ed for the Star Ledger where he essentially makes this point, saying, quote, "The courts can kill the line, but they can't force the party to reform its internal rules. The same goes for the legislature. This effort has to be a cultural fight, a battle for the soul of the party," close quote. Do party leaders need to do more to divest themselves from the political process?
That would be nice. You know, I would like to see something that is a little bit more democratic, but it's they're going to do what they want to do. They want to hold on to power, and they're going to try to continue exerting their power. Yes, they can still issue endorsements. That's fine. But I think the problem with the line was that so many people, when they walked into their polling place, if they're not somebody that's part of the county committee or part of the machinery, they had no, I mean, they just voted down the line because it was the most obvious thing. They didn't know what the other people on the ballot were there for if they were not an informed voter. So getting rid of the line takes away some of that power that they didn't necessarily earn. It was just the structure, the visual impact of it drove people to just vote down the line. So it's giving more, it's driving more votes towards their candidate, which I don't think is fair. At the time that I ran 2 years ago, there were people asking me to drop out once the endorsement went to another candidate. And then the question that I had was, what the hell is the primary for if there is only one candidate on it? Why are we wasting money on having an election? And why are we doing all this get out the vote if the decision has already been made by party bosses? It's just not democratic. So I will continue to fight that war. And I think who'd you say, Morgan or Moran, the one that wrote the article, I think they're correct. It is a cultural thing. And I will continue fighting it as such.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, Andy Kim was a fellow plaintiff in your lawsuit. He's currently running for Senate. Is it safe to say you'll be voting for him in June?
I already did.
All right, that makes it official right there. So your vote is without a doubt for Andy Kim. And also, before we go here, you mentioned that you believe there's a certain county where you're going to be sitting right next to President Biden on the ballot. Are you going to plan on voting for him? Because if you've seen the polling, he's not very popular here in New Jersey right now. Do you still consider yourself a supporter?
Yes, I do. I don't love everything that he does. And in fact, I am firmly against him in some areas. But I think he has done a lot of good during his 3.5 years. And I am a supporter of his. Yes.
All right. Well, we'll have to see where the president's campaign goes as well as yours. We will be watching. New Jersey 2nd District Democratic Congressional candidate Carolyn Rush, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that about wraps things up for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me as always. To stay in touch with what's going on the show, all you have to do is follow me on social media, which you can do on X at @Block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. You can also check me out on Instagram at joey.block.39. Again, that is at joey.block.39. Now, in case you just found the show for the first time, like, oh my God, I love the show. It's so great, but where do I find it? Well, here's what you got to do. You need to go to that browser of yours. You have to type in foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. Again, that is foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. You're going to put that in. It'll take you right to the Fox Sports New Jersey podcast page. You're going to scroll down until you find In the Middle with Joey Block. You're going to click on that, and all the episodes will be there. You'll have the newest one at the top and the older ones at the bottom. Now, I know we've had some issues in recent weeks with getting that posted. We believe we have all those figured out, so you should be able to access that very easily. We typically put out new episodes every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Now, obviously, we know it's a bit of a festive weekend. Cinco de Mayo is coming up. That's going to be this coming Sunday. So if you're out there celebrating, have fun, but also, you know, drink responsibly. No drinking and driving. We all know how that goes. So be responsible in that end. And also, the interesting part I like to tell people is Cinco de Mayo is, you know, everyone says, oh, it's Mexican Independence Day. Well, actually, it's not. That's September 16th. This is actually the celebration of a battle over Puebla, which is this part of Mexico where they were battling with the French over some territory. And basically, they won, and it was Mexican independence actually had happened prior to this. So this was just a celebration of a battle for Mexican independence. So that's what you're really celebrating out there, just so you know. And believe it or not, in Mexico, they really don't care very much about it. It's kind of a minor holiday. While here, it's a big deal, and it's a celebration of Mexican culture. And I'm sure a lot of you are having a lot of Mexican cuisine, your Mexican food, Mexican beer. Maybe you're just drinking in general, whatever your thing is. But nonetheless, enjoy. And, well, I'll have to see the weather cooperates. It looks like it's going to be a rainy weekend, but we shall see here. Thank you very much for listening. It has been a pleasure. We'll be back again next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports, New Jersey.